The Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Ms. Cheryl, please call the roll.
Chair Plasencia.
Here.
Vice Chair Mainey.
Here.
Representatives Pacello, excused. Grieco.
Here.
Hawkins.
Here.
Maygard, excused. Mariano.
Here.
McCurdy, excused. Nixon.
Here.
Rizzo.
Here.
Rodriguez, excused. Schoaf, excused. Ranking Member Thompson.
Here.
Tuck.
Here.
Zika.
Present.
You have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee. Please make sure that cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or on silent mode. Members, as you may recall, last year there was much discussion about the EASE grant program and the performance of the recipient institutions. In our conforming bill, HB 5601, we asked institutions to report to the Department of Education their annual accountability report. We asked the department and ICUF to make recommendations on how to move forward. Today, we will hear two presentations. First, Bob Boyd, President and CEO of the Independent Colleges and University of Florida, or ICUF, will be presenting. And second, on behalf of the Department of Education, we'll be hearing from Suzanne Pridgen, Deputy Commissioner of Finance and Operations, and Eric Hall, Senior Chancellor. Mr. Boyd, you are recognized.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I'm Bob Boyd. I'm the President and CEO of ICUF, which is the Independent Colleges and Universities of Florida. I appreciate it, Mr. Chair, allowing us to do this proposal to the committee. Let me just say one thing about your chair. I'm his biggest fan because he was accessible. He answered our emails. He was friendly and helpful. So, yeah, you have a good chair here, and I'm glad he included our proposal as you review this, the EASE performance metrics. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to say, I'm going to go recap very quickly about who ICUF is, but we do have members. I think it's Representative Thompson, Representative Grieco, Representative Rizzo, Representative Tuck, and Representative Zika all went to ICUF schools, so they know our sector. It's the University of Miami, University of Miami Law School, St. Leo, and Nova, and Stetson College of Law. Can't forget Stetson. So several of you are familiar with ICUF schools. But let me just kind of step back before I take a deep dive into the metrics and talk quickly about who ICUF is. Remember, ICUF is 30 independent, not-for-profit institutions in Florida. Many of them are older than our public institutions. They're four-year institutions. They're SACS accredited, which is the same accrediting body that accredits the public state universities and the state colleges. There's 160,000 students approximately, and we have 40,000 employees in the state at over 200 sites around the state. So we have a broad reach in the state. And if you could go to that last slide, there's just a quick map of where we are in Florida, but that's just the 30 main campuses. Like I said, we have over 200 campuses in Florida. For example, Kaiser has 19 campuses in Florida, I believe. So that's kind of where we are in Florida. And I'll tell you why this is important, but our association is extremely diverse. Our institutions have different missions, and we serve different students. And for example, we have three or four faith-based institutions. We have three of Florida's HBCUs. That's Bethune, Edward Waters, and Florida Memorial. We have five HSIs, which are Hispanic-serving institutions, where that's a majority of Hispanic students. That's Barry and St. Thomas and others. And then just like the institutions, Beacon College, which is in downtown Leesburg, their mission is to educate students with learning disabilities. And they only have about 450 to 500 students, all the way up to University of Miami and Nova, which have tens of thousands of students. Another good example is we have Embry-Riddle and Florida Tech on the Space Coast. Embry-Riddle is the largest aeronautical institution in the world other than the U.S. Air Force Academy. And then we've got schools like Ringling, which is an art and design school. So the point of it is we're extremely diverse, and it's difficult to come up with metrics because we cover such a broad array of universities. The other quick things are half of our students are from racial ethnic minorities. So one half of that 160,000 are racial ethnic minorities. Half of the students come from home incomes of 60,000 or less. So one half of that number. I believe I read that just for comparison, University of Florida, the average family income is about $106,000. So, and then 40% of our undergraduates, 40% are Pell eligible. So who we serve may be different than what you think. I know I gave you these facts and figures last session, but it's important when we talk about metrics that the student we serve may be the single mom raising kids, not able to graduate as quickly as a 18-year-old going to the University of Florida. They're non-traditional students. Many of them are over 25 years old, and their parents and veterans, et cetera. If you could just go to that real quick chart, this is a good chart I like to use. The gold is our institutions, and the white are the publics. And you'll see 8 out of the top 10 institutions in ICUF have undergrads that are 25 or older percentage-wise. We have 8 out of the top 10, same with a percent of undergrads receiving Pell. So that just gives you a good flavor of who our institutions are. Now, with regard to EASE, just to recap, 30 seconds, EASE is the Effective Access to Student Education Grant. It was passed in 1979. I got the award in 1981 at Rollins, and it was called the Florida Tuition Voucher. Then the name changed to FRAG, Florida Resident Access Grant, and today we have EASE. So that, all those grants are the same thing. It's an award passed in 1979. And if you look at the legislative intent of EASE, the legislative intent is clear. It's to create access for students, to save the taxpayer money because it has such a good ROI, and it's higher ed choice. So it's Florida's higher ed choice program. It creates access, and it has tremendous ROI. So that's kind of a quick recap of who we are and who the EASE is. Let me turn real quickly to the metrics and what we propose. So we were asked to create these metrics last year. The House considered metrics. We pushed back a bit because we feel that this is higher ed choice, that the student and the parent make the choice, that this is a student award. And if the student and parent decide that the student should go to Bethune-Cookman, they should be able to make that choice. There's not really any metrics like this on K-12 choice vouchers. So we did push back, but we also wanted to be good citizens. We wanted to come up with metrics. We were asked to do this, and we did it. We put together a task force. It took us about 3 or 4 months over the summer. We started with all the ICUF schools that gave input. Then we had a task force, and it narrowed down to a working group, and we came up with these metrics, and we I think we submitted them to the chair in August, maybe mid-August when we completed them. So we worked all summer on this. And if you can turn to the metrics, you'll see that there's five initial categories. It's access, retention, graduation, and workforce. That was what was in the statute, 5601. That was what the House wanted us to look at when it came to metrics, those categories. We use those categories, and then I'll talk about number 6 in a second. But what we did is, getting back to what I said about the ICUF institutions and how diverse we are and our different missions and students, we wanted to give flexibility in the metrics. So if you look, for example, under access, there's 4 choices, and then there's 4 choices under retention, which we call student success. Each institution could then choose 2 of those 4 that best fits their mission and the student they educate. And that built-in flexibility made these metrics work for us. So, for example, under number 1, that would total up to 20 points, 2, 20, 3, 20, 4, 20, 5, 20, which would add to 100 points. Now, just to do a compare and contrast, and I know the DOE is going to do their proposal, let's just take access. So access, that's number 1. The DOE and last year the House recommends that be Pell eligible. But you see that we add first-generation students, students that receive FSAG, which is Florida's need-based grant, students that are 25 years or older. And you want to add those categories, I think, because it's an advantage to Florida to have older students going back to getting their BA degree. It ties into the access issue. So you'll see how we kind of expanded the choices under that definition of access. And then if you go to number 2, you'll see that it's retention. And the DOE and the House recommended last year, these are students enrolled in 1920 who return in 2021. And that's a good metric, but we add a persistence rate, which includes students who transfer, how many students are in a STEM field, or how many students transfer in. So I'm not going to go through each metric, but you'll see how we create that flexibility to come up with our scoring system in our metrics. Number six is an institutional choice metric, and that is pulled from the Board of Governors metric, and we thought it was a good idea, where each institution can come up with a metric that's specific to their institution. For example, St. Leo has a lot of veterans and military-connected students that take programs online, so they could use that metric, and each school can come up with a metric that fits into their model or mission. So once you score these metrics, we came up with a proposal, and again, this is our proposal, that 60 or higher meets the expectations, and that you would allow those institutions to continue to award E's in year one. That does not mean that those expectations would be met every year. It would just be in year one, if you're 60 and higher, you would meet the expectations, and if you fell below 60, you would be on probation. Now, an important point I want to make is the probation would be 4 years. We have a 4-year glide path in our metrics, a 4-year phase-in. You know, we believe that why not collect the data? And last year when the House did this, we looked at IPEDS, which is 2-year-old data. Our position would be, why not collect the current data, look at the data, see where, for example, Bethune-Cookman is in year one, and then instead of punitively taking away E's from their students, look how that data changes over time. See how whether Bethune can correct the deficiencies in their performance by looking at that data over time. And that's why we have a 4-year glide path. The DOE model does take away E's from schools in year one. I don't know which proposal you will adopt, the DOE or ours or another proposal, but we would urge you and ask you to have some type of glide path in there where you can look at the data and allow us to cure our deficiencies going forward. So you will see our scoring model, and then you can turn to those following pages. I'm not going to go through them, but each one of those following pages are how the metrics are calculated. You'll see under 1A how we come up with a percentage for access rate, and that's what all those metrics are. And again, I'm not going to go through it, but we had folks working on our task force, like Dr. Eric Godin at St. Thomas University, who helped put together the Florida State College metrics, and Dr. Winslow. And that's how we calculate and get to the number of whether you meet 20 in that category and get to 60%. So you can go through those on your own if you have any questions. And then the last slide there is just our worksheet. So we put together a worksheet, and we entered all the scores in our proposal. All ICUF schools in year one in our proposal met the metrics. Some were close to 60, but all did. But again, remember, this is only 1 year. You're able to collect the data, and it does accomplish what you want. We're not afraid of accountability, and we want to see how the schools are doing. So that's basically how our metrics work. We have a probationary status and then a glide path. And again, I can't reemphasize how important it is to have that glide path. And again, this works for our sector. So the next thing I wanted to talk about is the impact of these metrics on a couple things. And we've been talking about this in the legislature about workforce. And I know we have a shortage of teachers and we have a shortage of pilots. Embry-Riddle is the number one producer of pilots in the state. But I want to talk about nursing real quick. And if we could go to the nursing slide, Liz. I'm not the expert in this area, but from what I've read, by 2035, Florida will be short nearly 60,000 nurses. 70% of hospitals in Florida are currently experiencing critical staffing shortages, according to the Florida Hospital Association. And then in committee, they said, we need more students, we need more professors, we need more seats for nurses. So you'll see, this is just one area where ICUF contributes to the pipeline of workforce. And you'll see that ICUF produces one-fourth, 25% of all the nurses in Florida, and we produce more than half of all the master's degrees in Florida, which is the pool that you pull out for your nursing instructors, and that's another shortage that has been discussed. So I would just submit to you that for every student that is declared ineligible under EASE because of metrics, you potentially lose these workforce students. I know, for example, St. Thomas and Bethune are two examples that graduate, maybe a fourth of their graduates are nurses. So if they were to lose EASE in year one and you take EASE away, I'm telling you that many of those students would drop out of those nursing programs. So I hope you will look at that and know that they would not be able to attend without EASE. You've had students come before you over the last couple of years saying without EASE and putting together a package with private student assistance grant and Pell and EASE, I'm able to attend Bethune because I want to make the choice of attending an HBCU in Daytona Beach. So hardline metrics disqualify students, and I'm not sure that's the best public policy for Florida right now when you're facing these workforce shortages. When you read articles, by the way, about the state universities and the state colleges' metrics, you always see that there's preeminence money that rewards institutions. If you have bright line metrics that are aspirational, you're punishing students. And remember, the statute has asked for minimum performance standards for EASE, not necessarily aspirational metrics. So again, why not collect the data and look at it, create a glide path, publish the data, do what we can to help the schools cure or fix the deficiencies before, you know, taking away that EASE award. Accountability, again, is important to us. We've proposed these metrics as a proposal. We'd like to talk to you if you'd like to, you know, tweak the scale or the scoring system. We think these metrics link performance and EASE funding, and they'll ensure that we remain high quality and accessible. Now, finally, I just want to make a couple comments about the DOE EASE metrics proposal and last year's House proposal. I know Dr. Pridgen is going to give more detail than I have, but I will say this, that last year, OSFA, which is the Office of Student Financial Assistance, and DOE changed the data collection system. All of our ICUF schools reported their data under the statute by September 1st. I've seen all the data. Everything was submitted in time. But when you look at the DOE proposal, you'll see there's some 0% on placement. Like, I think number one on the DOE proposal is Advent Health University that has 100% graduation rate but has 0% placement rate. Well, it just can't be right. I mean, all those nurses immediately go to Advent Health and start to work. So I just want to hope that the DOE will work with us to make sure the data is correct in their proposal. I know we can get it fixed, but I think there's four or five schools in that proposal that have 0% on placement rate, and that just can't be. It can't be 0%. It could be 20% or 30%, but it can't be zero. So I'm hoping that, the DOE this time self-reported their data. The ICUF schools self-reported their data to DOE. For the last 15 years or so, ICUF has produced a report where we collected the data, we made sure the data was right, and we submitted that to DOE. We'd love to go back to that model. We're fine doing this model as long as we all collect the right data. And then the last thing I would say, Mr. Chair, is if you look at the DOE proposal for 22-23, which would be the budget year we're working on right now, under their proposal, now let's just assume that you had to meet three of five of their metrics, 9 ICUF schools would drop out. There's no glide path. That's about 7,000 students and 70% of the EASE recipients. And again, a lot of those students are nursing students, healthcare workers, educators, and I'm not sure that's the right thing to do. And again, I would plead with you that if you are going to adopt bright line metrics, that there be a glide path or some type of phase in. So, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions, or if the DOE has any questions for me as well. But it was a pleasure presenting to you today.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. Members, are there any questions? Chair Mariano, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Bob, for coming today. And I just want to point out, Chair Placencia, I appreciate you bringing ICUF in here to present their metrics as well. I think that's a great addition as we can, you know, consider these metrics moving forward. Just a couple questions, and I appreciate you always coming to speak with me too to go over these things. But when the institutions were coming up with the metrics, how was that 60% of the 100 chosen as the minimum level?
Yeah, Representative Mariano, good question. I think in our mind, we looked at the statutory requirement in 5601 and in Proviso, and they use the word minimum performance standards. And so that's how we came up with the 60%. Again, like I said earlier, if that's something that needs to be tweaked or moved, that would be something we'd be agreeable to. Again, as long as there's a glide path in there, but that's how we came up with 60%. So if the optics, that's how, if the optics don't look good because it's 60 as opposed to more aspirational, I understand. But that's how we came up with the 60%. And so it was pretty random. I mean, it wasn't based on anything other than that language.
Okay. Follow-up?
Yep.
Do you know, and if you don't know off the top of your head, we can chat offline, how many of the institutions are between, like, 60 to 70?
There are several, and one thing I do want to say, and that's a good question, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, is that ICUF is 30 institutions, but there's four institutions that receive E's that are not in ICUF. So I do not have their data. And I do not, when I scored using our metrics, I scored just on the 30 ICUF institutions. But I think there, I can talk to you offline, but I think there's maybe four or five or six ICUF institutions between 60 and 70 in our model.
Okay, so majority are well above that.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Members, any other questions? I'll ask a couple questions, and if any other member, after I ask a question, would like to, you're more than welcome to. Mr. Boyd, thank you for your presentation. My question revolves around the student's ability to transfer. And so I don't want to just ask about Common Course numbering, but the general question is, what is the ability for a student to transfer and their credits be accepted at a state institution, whether it's a state college or a public university? And does it involve Common Course numbering or any other type of agreement that one of our ICUF schools may have with a state college or university?
Mr. Chair, there's some of our schools have adopted Common Course numbering, but not all, not the majority. But I will tell you this, that we have an articulation agreement with the state college system. So students transferring into our institutions, there's not been a problem with transfer of students to our sector. Again, it's SACS to SACS, even without Common Course numbering. And going the other way, I have not heard that it's an issue or a problem, especially given that we have these articulation coordinating contracts. We are on the Articulation Coordination Commission, and the articulation is not a problem that I've heard between our sectors of the ICUF schools.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. Members, are there any other questions? Okay. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair.
Presenting for the Department of Education will be Chancellor Hall. Chancellor Hall, you are recognized.
Good morning, Chair Placencia, Vice Chair Maney, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you today. And as mentioned, my name is Eric Hall, and I'm Senior Chancellor at the Department. And just again, always appreciate the opportunity to come before you, and thank you for your dedication and commitment to continuing opportunity and access for students across our state to put them on a pathway to post-secondary attainment and be able to work towards entering our workforce on a good, strong, positive pathway. I want to thank President Boyd, his team, and the collaboration and coordination and the work that we want to do together to really accomplish a common vision for, again, going back to what's best for students. So I just want to spend some time today kind of talking through where we are in the implementation and the overall recommendations going forward and the work that we can do for consideration in implementing this legislation. I'll kind of start out by saying, you know, today's conversation for us at the department, we want to be able to provide an overview on that implementation, as well as some of the considerations for the William L. Boyd the Fourth Effective Access to Student Education Grant, which you'll hear me refer to EASE throughout the conversation today. Just for context and giving some background, which I know everyone in this room is aware, this legislation was adopted in the 2021 session, and it really helps to amend Section 1009.89, which really is the section of statute that governs the EASE grant program. What we're looking at right now is we look at setting the metrics, and the metrics that are defined in statute and established in this particular legislation is focused on access, affordability, graduation, retention, and postgraduate employment and continuing education. And I think it's important to point out that these metrics are not just on students that are EASE recipients, EASE grant recipients, but on all students at the institutions that are first time in college, undergraduate, and Florida residents, and being able to look at those metrics in context. I will kind of say up front, you know, some of the data and information that we will share today and be discussing, it's preliminary data. This is self-reported data, and I really want to highlight that. I think the coordination and the collaboration we want to have with the institutions and the work that we've done so far to be able to bring this data in to inform conversation is really just that. It's preliminary data. It's information that we want to continue to use to help guide this conversation. When we look at the expectations and really the requirements laid out, it's important to point out that there's really two parts of this legislation. One is the part on the institutions themselves, which is reporting and providing the data and information to the department. That information that has come in, it's about setting performance for all eligible institutions, but also us being able to report back to the legislature and to the governor's office by October 1st of each year on those performance measures for those institutions, as well as those that have not hit those performance measures and those recommended standards. I mentioned earlier the metrics, and I just kind of want to talk you through what these different metrics really are intended to measure. We start with access rate, the percent of Pell-eligible students. The affordability rate is looking at the out-of-pocket expenses for the students after all other aid is considered, not student loans, but any federal, state, or institutional aid that's provided to the student. The graduation rate, oftentimes you'll hear this six-year graduation requirement. Oftentimes you'll hear this 150% of the graduation rate, which gets us to that six-year mark. The retention rate, those students that were there last year and then those students that are continuing this year. The measures that we've looked at here goes from 2019-20 and then those that returned in the 2021 school year. And then postgraduate employment and continuing education. Looking at once a student graduates from their undergraduate program, are they employed up to 120 days or within 120 days after graduation, or are they enrolled in a graduate program within that 120 day period? So again, what's happening to the students once they complete and get that undergraduate degree completed? Looking at those metrics, I just want to kind of highlight the work that the department has done, because that accountability back on us as an agency, being able to is that the first thing was our team sent out a memo to the institutions themselves to request this information and to explain the process for collecting the data. From there, our team continued to reach out to the institutions. They reached out to the financial aid directors, had conversations with them to help clarify and provided the information that was needed to ensure that they knew what data needed to come back in for reporting purposes, and then reached out to continue to review and confirm that data. Evaluated that data, and then from that, you're going to see here in just a moment what some of these initial measures start to look like. One thing I will highlight here at this point as I go into this data is that we haven't necessarily arrived on a first-year implementation. We want to talk with, you know, everyone involved and think about what does an implementation look like. President Boyd, you know, he mentioned a phase-in process. Could it be a multi-year strategy? We're at a point where we're open to those conversations and considerations and see what's going to be in the best interest of the state and, most importantly, the students that benefit from these programs. If you look at this data, and there's two slides worth, you'll see where the 34 institutions have been really kind of measured in these five areas with employment, graduation, retention, access, and affordability. I will point out here as well, under the affordability category, I think, you know, something that is important to clarify as well is that you could have a number that comes up as a negative number, and I will tell you how that happens. When you look at students who are eligible and receiving an EASE grant and also the Bright Futures academic grant or funding, the EASE grant is used first, and then the Bright Futures would be applied after. there could be excess funding available for those students, which could go towards rooming and board expenses and other things associated for that student and their expenditures for continuing their education. A good example of that in these numbers is reflected with St. Leo University, where you'll see actually kind of a loss recorded of $3,586. That's, again, that is funding that's in excess after all that aid is applied for the students. I don't want to go through all this data, but I just at least want to put it in front of you and explain really how we arrived at these metrics. Within each of those five areas, I think, you know, as mentioned earlier in the prior conversation with President Boyd, is that you have different institutions, different ways of approaching the work and different missions. Well, with that, we know that there are sometimes outliers in the data. So we looked at the three highest numbers in each metric and the three lowest. We removed those from the calculation and then averaged the remaining data to get us to these metrics. So you'll see with the access rate, 53%, affordability rate looking at $6,343, the graduation rate of 53%, retention rate of 68%, and then that postgraduate employment or continuing education rate of 49%. So these are the things that we've done really to try to look at this data on the front end. And I come back and I just want to reiterate that this is self-reported data, it's initial data, and our team will continue to work to make sure that we have the best available data as we look at these metrics. But in the end, if we're going to be focused and think about how do we put students on a pathway to good, strong opportunity post-graduation, using data to inform, and I appreciate, again, our colleagues and friends at ICUF, talking about how do we work hand-in-hand to balance accountability and access and get our institutions on a pathway to really good, strong implementation of this legislation so that we at the department can help to inform and provide data and information that's meaningful and helps to guide the vision forward for really what this implementation of the legislation is intending to do. So I want to pause for just a minute, Mr. Chair, and see if there's any questions, feedback for myself. I would tell you, Suzanne Pridgen, our Deputy Commissioner of Finance and Operations, we're both here to answer questions, but I think, again, I'll just reiterate here at the end, we have not landed on a first-year implementation. We have not gotten to that point, but you would see what the data would show if we did go in that direction. But we look forward to continuing that conversation and look at what's best for our state as we go forward. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chancellor Hall. Are there any questions, members? Chair Mariano, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. Good to see you. President Boyd had referenced the 0% numbers on the employment. Do you have, any way to shed light on those, specifically Advent Health, one that's clearly tied to an employer? 0% seems pretty unlikely, so can you shed some light on that? Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Chair. So I may actually defer to Suzanne Pridgen on this question, but I will just say, when we see these percentages, I just want to reiterate, we're continuing to collect data and information. I know our team has continued to reach out to institutions. Some of this data over time, too, and I'll use an example with, employment. FETPIP data is something over time that could help us in this area as well as we look at having something to help calculate. We use that data quite often with other institutions, but with the chair's permission, maybe I can defer to Suzanne Pridgen to take us deeper into that discussion.
Yes, so several of those institutions that had the 0%, they rely on FETPIP to report that data. So FETPIP didn't have the most recent data the year that we were asking for. So we have to go back and rework that particular metric to make sure that we have the correct data from everyone.
Can I follow up? So are you saying that in a previous year it was 0%, or you're just saying it's the data is not there, so 0% was what was written?
That's right, for 2021.
Can I follow up? I guess more of a comment, and maybe more... maybe better for us to view if instead of 0%, it maybe says NA or something along those lines as to not demonstrate that there's a 0% employment rate at any of these institutions.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Members, Representative Hawkins, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You say you're still working on implementation and that. Do you have a in-house calendar as to when you're going to say we want something in place by this point?
Mr. Chair, I think we want to work as expeditiously as we can. So I don't have an exact date, but I know our team is constantly looking at this data, I think to the point about how do we get the most information that we can from the data. But very soon, obviously, because we're at the point of having to work towards implementation, getting information back to both the legislature and the governor's office so that we can move forward. But no, sir, I don't have an explicit date, but I can tell we're moving expeditiously.
Members, any other questions? I do have a question. So I have a couple of questions, Chancellor. On affordability, did you take into account any loans that students have taken out?
No, sir.
Okay.
We did not include student loans for that purpose. We looked at other financial aid by the Fed, state, or institutional level.
Okay. Thank you. And on the employment metric, what type of reporting do we have on students who are either enrolled in a postgraduate institution out of state, or have gotten a job out of state, or have gone to the military?
I think those are the kind of data points that we've got to continue to dive into, unless, okay. You know, Deputy Commissioner, you have more detail, but I think those are some of the data elements. As we continue to refine and look at how do we bring this in for full implementation, we have to continue to gather that data and information.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Chancellor, Ms. Pridgen, for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, you know, as I think last year there was a lot of discussion about this, obviously, and there was also the ABLE institutions and their the grants that we had for the ABLE institutions that we eliminated in last year's budget. Now, I want to be very clear, and I want to state publicly, in no way are we saying that our ICUF schools are not performing. Most of us have ICUF schools in and around our district, and those are schools that we're very proud of. Before I got into the process, if you were to ask me about some of our best institutions in the state of Florida, not necessarily understanding the differences between ICUF and state university, and state, not the entire population of it, I would have probably listed a number of ICUF schools alongside our state universities in what I believe are some of the best higher education institutions in our state and in the entire country. So I want to make it clear that in this process, in trying to bring some accountability, we're not inferring that there is a lack of performance within our ICUF schools. That being said, we do want to make sure, just like we have with our state university system and with our state college system, that there is accountability that can be measured, not just for the sake of our state budget, but also to inform our residents and our constituencies what they're investing in and what they're going to get out of it. And at the same time, I think each institution, just like our state university and our state colleges, want to know how they can do better and how they're measured against their peers. And so I believe that's what this process is. It is not a punitive process. It is just a way to measure and a way to hold accountability and to make sure that we continue to have the best college and university system in the entire nation. I want to commend Bob Boyd and his entire team at ICUF for always engaging, for having an open door policy, and for really working hard on this throughout the entire year, even over the summertime while we were back in our districts, and also the Department of Education for being a partner in this as well. At the end of the day, the most important thing we can do here is collaborate. Those of us on the committee, all members within the House and the Senate, the Department of Education and ICUF, to make sure that what we put forth in this year's session is something that is to the benefit of the entire state of Florida and all the institutions. So, members, are there any questions, comments, suggestions before we wrap this up? Okay. This concludes our committee agenda. Is there any further business before the committee? Seeing none, Representative Hawkins, move we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.